You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Our guest today encourages us to move beyond hand-me-down beliefs and religions. Instead, he invites us to co-create with spirit and follow a path of a direct experience of the sacred. Our collective plunge down this steep slope of progress has come at the cost of a deep, intuitive connection with nature and our authentic spiritual selves. This has resulted in a profound disenchantment of life. Today, we'll be exploring a way to reclaim the wonder and hope that will give meaning to our lives and our world with our guest, Dr. Hank Wesselman. Hank Wesselman is a respected paleoanthropologist who has worked with noted anthropologists around the world, including Ethiopia, investigating the mystery of human origins in the Great Rift Valley. Besides his training and scientific work, he's a shamanic student, practitioner, and teacher, now in the 30th year of his apprenticeship. He lives with his wife, Jill, in Hawaii. In addition to his scientific publications, his 7 books on shamanism include The Spirit Walker Trilogy, Awakening to the Spirit World, co-authored with Sandra Ingerman, The Bowl of Light, Ancestral Wisdom from a Hawaiian Shaman, and The Re-Enchantment, A Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder. Join us for the next hour as we explore the shamanist path and how to reclaim our wonder and hope for our world with our guest, Dr. Hank Wesselman. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Hank, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be with you once again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure as well. Thank you for coming. I'd like to begin. I know your work is about following the shamanic path that can lead us to transformational spirituality. So, who or what is a shaman?
Well, you know, in the Western world, there's a lot of confusion, I think, between the kind of work that shamans do and the kind of work that medicine people do. And this confusion exists because every shaman is a medicine person, but not all medicine people are shamans. In fact, among the various indigenous tribal groups of people I've lived with across the years, it's been my discovery that most medicine people are not shamans, but they fulfill social roles more like those of priests in our organized religious traditions. What do I mean by this? Well, they tend to serve their communities as ceremonial leaders, as ritual leaders, conducting ceremony and ritual throughout the year. And this is not to diminish the work that they do, because they hold the equilibrium, both the physical and metaphysical equilibrium of their communities, in their capable hands. And they may have great knowledge of the healing arts.
So they're important. They're not dismissing them.
But the medicine person does their main work in this world.
Like the world of the physical.
The physical world. Uh-huh. Whereas the shaman works in the other worlds, in the spirit worlds. Technically, a shaman is an individual who discovers, sometimes in childhood, sometimes in adulthood, that they have the ability to alter their consciousness, to go into trance very easily. And when they do this, they literally re-geography their awareness away from the physical world into a transpersonal world, which the indigenous people call the spirit world or the other world. And the first thing the shamanic neophyte or acolyte discovers is that this world is inhabited. It's inhabited by transpersonal forces that the traditional people call spirits. And these include, you know, the spirits of elementals, the spirits of nature, the spirits of animals, the spirits of plants, the spirits of the dead, the spirits of ancestors, as well as those higher organizing intelligences that many people call angels. Now, through relationship with these transpersonal forces, shamans are able to do various things, initially on behalf of themselves, and then increasingly on behalf of others. The shaman is really a public servant. Shamanism is not primarily a method for self-development, although it can be used like that in the beginning. It's really a service occupation in which the shaman is in service to their community as a healer. And, you know, shamans do various things, and we could talk about that. But, you know, the shaman does their main work in the other world. And so I remember asking Michael Harner, who many people are familiar with, I remember asking him about 35 years ago, what are those features that reveal somebody to be an authentic shaman? And he got right to the point. You know, he said, first of all, do they journey to other worlds? Secondly, do they have relationships with spirits? And thirdly, do they perform miracles? Now, this last statement is sometimes problematic for people, but let me just say that over the 25 years I've been teaching, I have watched, astonished, as non-tribal Western people can access this altered state of consciousness quite easily. I send them off with a set of coordinates without telling them what to see. This is not about guided visualization. And then they return 15 or 20 minutes later with accounts that would pass muster at any Aboriginal campfire. And in terms of miracles, I've been watching healing go on in these workshops, as I've said, all the time I've been teaching. And I've watched people with very serious afflictions come to these workshops for healing. And often, not always, but often, these afflictions just go away. I'm not talking about that stiff tennis elbow or that, you know, torn shoulder joint. I'm talking about illnesses like cancer and Crohn's disease and lupus and multiple sclerosis. Although I'll have to say, multiple sclerosis is very, very hard. I believe it can be stopped from advancing. But once it's demyelinized, those upper motor root neurons, it's very difficult to remyelinize them again. But I think it can be halted, and I've watched this happen among people who've come to the workshops. So I could give you examples of these if you wish, but we could just also press on because there's a lot to talk about.
There's much to talk about, and we could get really hung up on the miracles. And I don't want to go into that too much because I think that really the purpose of the book is really about creating a new cultural mythos. I mean, that's the big overriding. I mean, there are individual needs that we have, but there is also a planetary need that we have. And I want to know your advice or your view of how we can do that. And first of all, I'd love for our listeners to know something about you, Hank, and going back into a little bit of your early experiences where you use the word re-enchantment, the re-enchantment, and it's the title of your book. And that's such a powerful image and idea to to re-enchant. And you go back, you begin by telling us the story of your first memory of being enchanted. And it was when you were, what, 3 or 4 years old in a stroller. Can you tell us?
That's true. That's a very strong memory for me. My family and I lived in an apartment on the Upper East Side of New York, so we had access to Central Park. And my mother, or my au pair, used to take me to the park almost every day, unless the weather was inclement. And I remember when I was about 3 or 4 years old, maybe 5, I looked up at the trees, and I had this interesting insight. I realized that the trees were living beings like myself, but they were different. And then I looked at the pigeons bobbing and cooing and mobbing each other for the breadcrumbs my mother was spreading out for them on the sidewalk. And they were also living beings like myself, but they were different. And then there were the squirrels, these rather hyper-furry ambassadors. And I remember one day offering a peanut to a squirrel who perched on the side of my stroller. And for one long moment, this squirrel looked deeply into my eyes. And I was enchanted. I was enchanted by none other than Mother Nature herself. Then there was the zoo. There's a zoo in Central Park, and I went there often with my mother. And the memories of that time and the imagery and the smells and the sounds are still with me to this day. And I remember one day seeing an extraordinary creature in a cage. It was one of the most beautiful creatures I'd ever seen. It was a leopard. And I didn't know what leopards were, but I watched this leopard pacing in ever-narrowing circles in its cage. And I had another deep insight that within this graceful spotted body, there was a great will that was imprisoned. And with that awareness, something happened. And suddenly I was transported. It was like being in a dream, although I was very much awake. It was like being in a dream, and I found myself in a place of blueness. It was blue. And the leopard was there, and there were no bars between us. And the leopard looked deeply into my soul with that green gaze, and something happened. Now, what happened eludes me today. I reach for it, and I cannot recapture it. But the leopard became my kind of imaginary childhood friend. It wouldn't come in the apartment building, of course. What I didn't realize was that leopards like to stick to cover. They're covert operators, and they're ambush hunters. But when I went to the park, the leopard was always there, and we would have these inner adventures together, kind of like Calvin and Hobbes. You remember that wonderful...
Oh, I love that cartoon.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Hobbes was a tiger. Well, mine was a leopard. And, you know, as I grew up, of course, the magic and the mystery began to fade. They began to fade, and by the time I was an adolescent, I was fascinated with the female of the species, as Zorba the Greek described them. I loved Cousin Zakas's writings. He's one of my faves. And the mystery withdrew. The magic withdrew. And then, one day in Africa, when I was on expedition with a research team in southwestern Ethiopia, I began to have these very strange experiences. During the daytime, when I was very much awake, they were like dreams, but waking dreams. And I remember one that was very important. I think it was in 1972.
I want you to complete that story. I don't want to interrupt it. So I want to have you hold it and remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Hank Wesselman, and he is the author of The Reenchantment, A Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, sharedwisdom.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Thank you. here with Dr. Hank Wesselman, and he's the author of The Reenchantment, A Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder. And Hank, you were just about to tell us this experience you had as here you are, a paleoanthropologist in Africa, Ethiopia, and it's daytime, and suddenly, almost unbidden by you, I mean, you weren't thinking about it, you weren't concentrating on it, but you had an experience.
Well, I was working with three African men. I was in a safari camp, by the way. We were 600 miles from the nearest cold beer or hot bath, and we would be out there for 3 months at a time, doing survey work in these sedimentary deposits along the lower Omo River, which flows into Lake Turkana to the south and drains the Ethiopian highlands to the north. We had 50 people in the camp, scientific people, we had African people, and on this particular day I was excavating a site which was a little over 3 million years old, from which the fossilized remains of animals were being recovered, crocodiles and fish and turtles and buffaloes and antelopes and carnivores and so forth and so on, including the fossilized remains of very early humans, still in the process of becoming human. They were more like proto-humans. So I was excavating this site, and I'd had this experience for several days in a row where I suddenly became aware of the fact that I was being watched by something. Now, this is a kind of eerie experience on the one hand, and when you're in Africa, maybe 100 yards or more from your Land Rover, there are lions, and there are leopards, and there are hyenas, and there are buffalo, and they're all dangerous. So this was concern-making, to say the least. Well, on this particular day, we were preparing to go back to camp for lunch. Probably the temperature was hovering around 110 degrees, maybe 115, and the two African men who were Wakamba, the Kambas are a tribe from Kenya. Their names were Mathoka and Kambulu. They were loading the equipment back into the Land Rover. But the third African was a man from that region, the Dasnich tribe, that the Kenyans call the Marile. This man was a shaman. His name was Loki Riakwanga, but everybody called him Otiko. Otiko spoke six languages, but none of them was English, and I didn't speak any of the languages he spoke, although I could manage a little Swahili. And on this particular day, this shaman was watching me with some intensity, and as I felt this feeling of being watched, I wondered if it was coming from him. But as I stood up and I dusted myself off, I watched his eyes slide to my left, and my eyes followed him and his gaze, and I saw something. It was big, and it was about, it was in the air. It was above the ground, it seemed, and it seemed to have spots or dots. And as I looked directly at it, it's though whatever it was stepped through a rip in the fabric of the air and then zipped it closed from the other side, leaving a momentary wrinkle that straightened out and then was gone. Well, I blinked and I looked at this, and I thought to myself, maybe it's time to go back to Nairobi and have a beer, you know? But, you know, in this case, I turned and looked at the shaman, and he was watching me again. And I suddenly knew that he'd seen it, and he knew that I'd seen it, and he knew that I knew that he'd seen it. And so I looked at him, and I said to him in Swahili, Otiko, what was that? And he turned and he pointed at directly where it had been in the air, and said a single word in Swahili. He said the word Shaitani. Shaitani is the word for spirit. But in those days, I worshipped solely at the altar of science. I wasn't interested in spirits. I wasn't interested in the soul. And I just sort of took it in and made notes to myself in my journal and then kind of let it go. But it was the onset of a number of strange things that happened. You know, I could share one more, which is a very poignant memory. We used to hunt every Tuesday and Saturday for meat for the camp, because we were 50 people in the field. And there were large herds of gazelles, Grant's gazelles, that populated the savanna grasslands around the camp. And so one afternoon, the director of the expedition, a professor from Berkeley named F. Clark Hull, he and I and a third None other than Don Johansson, the guy who would eventually find Lucy. In those days, he was still a grad student like myself.
And Lucy was like the ancient bones of one of the early humanoids.
Yeah, she's right. One of the famous ones.
Yeah.
Lucy.
Yeah.
3.5 million years old, roughly speaking.
Mm-hmm.
He would find Lucy 2 years after this experience. Well, the three of us went out hunting, and the hunt was successful. And on our way back to camp, with a gazelle and several guinea fowl in the back, we were driving across what's called a clay pan. A clay pan during the rainy season is filled with water, but during the dry season, it's dry. And this clay pan was several miles across with this fringing, dark, rather leafless, scrubby acacia woodlands around the border. And as we're driving across the clay pan, I saw this thing ahead of us that looked like a gourd, which was drying in the sun. And as we passed the gourd, suddenly my professor looked at me and reached down and turned the car off. As the car drifted to a stop, we got out and we walked back. And there on the surface of the pan was a human cranium. And it was a fairly fresh one with the muscles still attached. And he reached down and picked it up. No jaw, just the cranium. And he shook it, and the brain was still inside, the desiccated, shrunken brain bumping around. And he pointed out where a cheekbone had been gnawed off and a mastoid process had been gnawed off, probably by jackals. And the eyes, of course, were gone, pecked out by vultures. And he hypothesized that maybe a vulture had taken this skull up high and dropped it, hoping to break it open. And then he passed it to me. And as I held the skull in my hands, my fingers traced the contours of the cranium, and I perceived it as female because the parietal prominences were strong and her face was very delicate. Teeth were in wear. And as I gazed into the face, something happened. Now, what happened still eludes me to this day, but I suddenly heard this sound of rushing water. And as I looked from side to side, it was still dry. There was no water there, but it sounded like rushing water. And then, abruptly, my consciousness seemed to expand dramatically. And I found myself in a situation where my hankness, my carefully cultivated scientific persona, just simply evaporated, and it was gone. And I found myself in this place of vastness. It was a vast place filled with golden dots, both warm and cool, both dark and light, and they were moving. And I was in this vastness, and in those moments I knew what the vastness knew, but Hank was completely gone. And abruptly, Don Johansson reached out and took the skull for me, and I was back. I was back.
So
had I gone?
That it was broken, like wherever you would. Suddenly, you're now back in this reality.
It was broken.
So you had a propensity for these things. You didn't really search it out, but they happened to you. They just came upon you. And I was interested in one other story that goes back to your childhood, but it brought it forward. Years later, you were doing a workshop with Michael Harner, who does shamanic traveling and journeying with people and through drumming and stuff like that. And he had an exercise or process where you were paired up with Sandra Ingerman. And you didn't have a lot of faith in this process at all, but, you know, all right, you'll try it. And something very profound happened when she called up something for you. Can you tell us what that was?
Well, this happened at the time I was finishing my doctoral dissertation, and I was very busy. But a friend
so
of my wife,
so as a scientist, so to speak,
and I'm the scientist,
materialist scientist, right?
You got it.
Yep.
Well, a friend of my wife's called, and she said, "Listen, Hank, there's an anthropologist coming to town. He's going to teach a weekend workshop on shamanism. You're going to love it." And I wasn't so sure. I was busy. And frankly, the thought of spending the weekend with a bunch of flaky New Agers didn't exactly thrill me. But, you know, it was the memory of those experiences in Africa they haunted me for years. This is 10 years later.
Because you had just put them aside. They happened, but you never really followed through on them.
That's right. I went to the workshop. I think that's the reason I went. And Harner had us do an exercise with a partner in which we did a couple of journeys. And in each journey, one of us would journey on behalf of the other to find a helping spirit, to be in relationship. And I wasn't too sure about this, but I found myself partnered with this very beautiful young woman with long hair and dark eyes named Sandra Ingerman. And I had no idea who she was. She was a grad student at the CIIS in San Francisco in counseling psychology. And so we paired up. And in the journey that happened, I found myself lying on the floor next to this woman with the great Michael Harner blamming away on his drum. And it's dark. I think we were in a high school gymnasium, but I'm not sure now, so many years later. And in the midst of the journey, suddenly Sandra sat up next to me and looked at me with some intensity. And then she leaned over, and I remember her long hair drifting across my face, and she planted her mouth on my chest and blew into my heart. And something happened. I got pricklies all over. In Hawaii, we call that chicken skin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, prickly's all over. And then she sat me up and blew into my head. And then she waited until the drumming was complete. And then she described what she had experienced. She had journeyed. That is, she had projected her conscious awareness into the lower world, which is the dreaming of nature, the great dream world of nature. And there she'd encountered a being that said it was one of my old friends and wanted to come back into relationship with me once again. And lo and behold, she then sits there and describes the leopard to me. I used to call him the leopard man because he would stand up on his back legs, kind of like a human being. He would sort of mimic what humans do, how they present themselves. And so I called him the leopard man. And she described him doing this in her vision. Now, this got my attention. I mean, nobody knew about the leopard man.
You never talked to your mother or anybody, friends, nothing?
It was a clandestine relationship.
Yes.
And this was the beginning of my re-enchantment, really, because my whole life changed after that. And it was like 4 or 5 years later, I found myself in Hawaii. And all the visions that make up the Spirit Walker trilogy began at that point. And the Leopard Man was one of the guys who facilitated that process.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. So this really gives us the context of your journey and where now 30 years later, here you are. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Hank Wesselman, and he's the author of The Reenchantment, A Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder. If you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, sharedwisdom.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps.